This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where during the first hour I want to review the developments of the last 10 days or so in relation to the primary in Indiana tomorrow, which I am terribly concerned is going to be stolen from Donald Trump. I'll explain exactly why. I think there have been several precedents that showed signs of the kind we're seeing here and where it's going to be very bad if it happens. But that's my prediction. I want to begin now with the first slide about Donald's estate sweep from last Tuesday. It was absolutely sensational. This is one of the greatest political triumph in American history, actually of all time. If you turn to the second slide, I can review the delegates he won in Connecticut, 58% to 12 for Cruz. Kasich actually came in second. Delaware, 61% to 20 for Kasich, Cruz 16. Maryland, 54% to 23 for Kasich, Cruz 19. Pennsylvania, 57 for Trump, 19 for Kasich. In that case, Cruz came in second with 22. Rhode Island, Trump 64, Kasich 24, Cruz 10. So in four of the five states, Cruz actually finished third. It's very, very strange, therefore, that he continues to talk about himself and promote himself and take some bizarre actions that one would only think would be appropriate were he, at the very least, a front runner, if not actually the determined nominee of the party. You see, Hillary's victories over Bernie, 4 out of 5, 52 to 46 in Connecticut, 60 to 39 in Delaware, 63 to 33 in Maryland, 56 to 44 in Pennsylvania, but in Rhode Island, Bernie pulled it off 55 to 43. Just to give you an indication of the dimensions of this sweep, in Pennsylvania, for example, Donald Trump took all 80 of the 80 counties in Pennsylvania, and my impression is he may have taken every county in all the other states as well, which is truly astonishing. The next slide gives us an update on where the delegates stand. Trump with 953, meaning 1,237 to win. Cruz, 400 plus back. Marco Rubio, not actively campaigning. Kasich with 153. With the Democratic delegates, 1,662 for Hillary, including 520 superdelegates. Bernie, 1,365, including his 39. So, The Democratic Party with his superdelegate thing had it really loaded in favor of Hillary Clinton. There's no question about it. The Donald's problems have been different because the Republican Party has been working against him. In fact, I've observed here in Wisconsin on the day of the Wisconsin primary, 5 April, as I recall, that I'd never seen a candidate who was so pilloried. And when a caller who was a bit of a shill, I'm sorry to say, called in to say, no, he thought that Matt Romney had it worse, I pointed out that that Trump was being attacked by both sides, by his own party, as well as the Democrats. It wasn't even a contest, not even close. Well, here on the fourth slide is a projection of how Trump could get the 1,237. Notice, in Indiana tomorrow, there are 57 candidates up, If it's an honest election, then he'll get a big bump. He may even take all 57. And then we have Nebraska, West Virginia, Oregon, Washington, California, the biggie with 172 up for grabs, which ought to put him over. But if not, there are other states such as Montana, New Jersey with 51, New Mexico, and South Dakota, where New Jersey, I think, is going to go completely for Trump. So it looks to me extremely promising for the Donald, even if there's a bump in the road tomorrow, which I'm sorry to say I'm predicting to be the case. I'll be very, very glad to be proven wrong. The next slide reflects the fact that the Donald gave a foreign policy speech. This was only the second formal speech he's given during this campaign. The first being a, to my mind, rather disappointing performance at AIPAC, where it seemed to me he was entirely too obsequious to Israeli and Zionist interests, though I think they were not quite convinced by what he had to say, and that they are promoting Cruz, in my estimation, as the guy who's going to be best for Israel, not the Donald. But it was a wonderful speech. He articulated many dimensions of a foreign policy that would be non-interventionist, not involved in all these wars of aggression in the Middle East, one that would expect our allies, for whom we've been providing defense, to pay their fair share, reconsidering the role of NATO. All of this is completely appropriate. And as the next slide shows, even the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Coker from Tennessee, praised the speech. This is an extremely positive sign, because the Donald is being faulted for having no foreign policy experience. And that he presented an excellent speech on foreign policy goes a long way. He did, of course, assail Iran improperly, declaring that in his administration, Iran will not be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons. But since Iran is not even pursuing nuclear weapons, that's going to be the easiest plank in his platform to satisfy. Iran doesn't want nukes, isn't pursuing nukes. So for the Donald to say he won't allow them to acquire them gives him a rhetorical advantage on a promise that he most assuredly can keep, insofar as Iran is not now and has not, at least since 2007, when all 16 U.S. intel agencies concluded that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, a conclusion they reaffirmed in 2011, or even the Mossad concluded in 2012 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons just 3 weeks before Bibi Netanyahu went to the United Nations and asserted precisely the opposite. Another positive development came from Pat Buchanan, as we see in the next slide, where Buchanan is talking about Trump putting America first, meaning that he's going to take into consideration the interests of the United States rather than, just go all out for types of policies that we have seen rampant since Bush and Cheney of regime change and endless wars in the Middle East, where both he and Bernie Sanders are on exactly the same side here. Pat Buchanan actually is a very smart guy. It's surprising for someone who's often regarded as an ideologue. I find Pat Buchanan's analysis to be very accurate, very objective. He doesn't mince words. He gets right to the heart of the matter, and he's impressed me tremendously. So I think the fact that Pat Buchanan was endorsing, embracing, supporting, praising Trump's foreign policy speech was a very positive development as well. Now, he mentions in his comments that this phrase America First has a history, and it turns out, as the next slide shows, that's been used as a line of attack on Donald Trump, because there was, in the past, an America First movement prior to World War II, in which even Charles Lindbergh participated, the first man to fly across the Atlantic, and that it was an intervention, an isolationist movement at that point in time. It was trying to keep the United States out of wars, Now, here you have the ADL, which is the muscle, political muscle, for the AIPAC, American-Israeli Political Action Committee. They call it public affairs, but it's a PAC. It's a well-known, the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C., coming out to attack Trump because of the use of the phrase America first. Well, this is a juvenile kind of argument, training on an equivocation. It's something I taught undergraduates to avoid during the 35 years I spent offering courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. I was therefore simply floored when Tom Hartman featured Lamar Waldron on his show last week during the last half hour, which is something that a propagandist likes because then there's no one to call in because the show's off the air to contest what you're saying, and admitted he had not heard the speech. So here he was talking and attacking Trump because he'd used the phrase America first, completely independent of what Trump meant by it, which was simply putting American interests first, and going on and on and on about this historic precursor using the same name but with a very different character, which was an isolationist movement, which, according to Lamar Waldron, had various anti-Semitic aspects to it. Frankly, it was to me extremely disappointing that Tom Hartman would feature a man of this caliber, where I've encountered Lamar Waldron before. In fact, he and Tom Hartman, who I suspect had a very minimal role in relation to the book, published something called Ultimate Sacrifice about the death of JFK, where they claimed that the mob had learned that Jack was going to invade Cuba, to which they refer as C-Day, to parallel D-Day, the invasion of Normandy, and that the mob took him out and then kept Bobby quiet by threatening to reveal that Jack was going to reinvade Cuba. And so Bobby could do nothing about it. This is about as stupid a theory as I've ever encountered. Number one, JFK had announced to the world after the abortive Bay of Pigs that we would not invade Cuba. It would have been a disgrace to the United States to have done so after the president of the United States had given his word. He most certainly was not undertaking some invasion of Cuba. C-Day was a complete fantasy. If they had anything to support it at all, it may have been some contingency plan, given that the Pentagon provides contingency plans for everything, but it wasn't serious. And Lamar Waldron to present it as though he was actually planning to do that was incredibly irresponsible. Number two, if Jack had been planning to invade Cuba, the mob was so keen on recovering its resorts and casinos that would have allowed that to happen. And then if they had an issue with Jack, they would have taken him out afterward. The idea of taking him out before a planned invasion of Cuba is about as preposterous a proposition as I've ever encountered. And if you want to go to Amazon.com, you can find my review of Ultimate Sacrifice there, entitled Ultimate Rubbish, because that's exactly what it was. And for Lamar Waldron to give us a book about JFK that's ultimate rubbish and then to come on the Tom Hartman show and abuse his position by trashing Trump because of a phrase America first when he, by his own admission, had not even heard the speech is a complete disgrace. I say to you, Lamar Waldron is not a trustworthy individual and you should never believe anything he says. Completely disgusting. Irresponsible, disgraceful. Tom Hartman abdicated his responsibility here, though he did put up some perfunctory issues debating with Lamar Waldron. It was nevertheless contemptible. Here's now the most interesting situation we confront tomorrow. Leading up to tomorrow, because Ted Cruz has been desperate after the Donalds. Brilliant. I mean, absolutely magnificent taking of five states by these historic margins, a clean sweep. He initially dallied with a collusion with John Kasich, where he asked Kasich, to divide their resources so Kasich wouldn't invest resources in Indiana, but in two other states, and Cruz would get his opportunity to go one-on-one. But he betrayed Kasich right off the bat by talking about Kasich as having pulled out of Indiana. When Kasich was questioned about it, he was completely buffaloed. He had no idea what this meant, him pulling out, because he's still a candidate there. He still wants people to vote for him. I think when you talk about Lying Ted, this was just one more illustration. Given the Kasich thing backfired and looked like an act of desperation, he tried yet another, even more desperate gambit by tapping Carly Fiorina to be his vice presidential running mate, which, frankly, when you contemplate the situation, given that it's not even mathematically possible that Ted Cruz could win the nomination, and where he endlessly talks about there are nobody going to secure the 1,237 votes before the convention, he's whistling in the dark. Donald has multiple ways of making the 1,237. Cruz has exactly none. Zero, zip, zilch, nada. So who does this guy think he is? He speaks with a great messianic fervor as though he were God's designated appointee to run for president and become the leader of the free world. It's complete rubbish, especially when you get down into the nitty-gritty and discover the guy's a philanderer, has had multiple mistresses at his Senate office, subscribed to the Ashley Madison Adultery Magazine, that his name is in the D.C. Madam's Little Black Book. When are evangelical Christians going to recognize that this man is a moral imbecile, that he has betrayed the principles for which he professes to stand, and that far from being an exemplar of moral virtue, he's a pathetic, disgraced adulterer who has no business pretending to be a pure soul on the campaign circuit. I'll return to further considerations here, but in my judgment, no evangelical Christian ought to be enthusiastic about voting for a Ted Cruz. Now, so he taps Flory Corina, and as you see in the next slide, Andy Borowitz, who's a wonderful satirist, just made mincemeat of this. Cruz hopes to tap into the immense popularity of Carly Fiorina. Listen to some of what Andy wrote. In choosing the former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina as his running mate, Senator Ted Cruz hopes to tap into the immense popularity of one of the most beloved public figures in America. Minutes after the news of Cruz's selection leaked, political insiders called the choice of the widely adored Fiorina game-changer for the Cruz campaign. It's no secret that Ted Cruz has some trouble with likability, the Republican strategist Harley Dorison said. What better way to fix that than by choosing Carly Fiorina, a person everyone is absolutely crazy about? Fiorina's reputation for winning the hearts of everyone she comes in contact with dates back to her days as the incredibly well-liked CEO of Hewlett-Packard and before that Lucid Technologies. Well, for a dose of realism and to appreciate the biting satire of Andy Borowitz, consider this political cartoon, which just appeared in the Wisconsin State Journal, slide number 11. Which was adopted from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. PoliticalMatch.com, you all know Match.com advertised on television all the time. They have the best rate for second dates, so it's considered to be excellent. So here, Political Match. And why did Cruz pick Carly? Well, he's looking at her resume, where she fired 30,000 workers, was canned as CEO, failed at a failed Senate campaign. And Carly looks at why she should be the running mate of Ted Cruz, shut down the U.S. government, universally despised, losing to Donald Trump. I mean, there's a little dose of reality. In other words, this was a simply absurd choice of Carly Fiorina, who's going to do Ted Cruz no good whatsoever, none, zilch, zero. Plus, John Kasich was a bit ticked off because, after all, he'd actually been in collusion with Ted about this division of resources. So he had a legitimate reason to be ticked off. But get this, too. It means he gave away maybe the only bargaining chip he had, who would be his running mate, which he could have used with, say, Marco Rubio or John Kasich to get additional delegates. They, after all, have some. Carly Fiorina has none. So where do we stand now on the eve of the Indiana primary? Slide number 12. Dates, polls, who will win? Numbers for Trump, Cruz, Clinton, Sanders. There are 57 Republican and 92 Democratic delegates available. The delegate process is pretty straightforward. Three delegates are awarded from each of the state's nine congressional districts, with the candidate who receives the most voting taking them all. The other 30 delegates will be awarded to the candidate who wins the most votes statewide. Now, ordinarily, I would tell you this is a shoe-in for Trump. He's going to take them all. But look at the next slide, number 13. This is a sign that something is wrong. Here we have a new Indiana poll puts Cruz up by 16 points over Trump. This is a manifest absurdity. Nobody cares about Ted Cruz. All the action is on Trump. Even today, there were lines, blocks long to get in to see Trump. Nobody cares about Cruz. Nobody's excited about him. For them to report Cruz at 45%, Trump 29% is a reversal of what actually appears to be the situation, to wit, Trump at 45 with Cruz at 29. And the reason I say this is a sign that they're planning to steal the election is I've seen this before. When we had here in Wisconsin the contest between Scott Walker and Mary Burke for governor, where the Democrats were very enthusiastic, the Republicans were not, where Michelle Obama had come to the state twice, Barack once, the big dog Bill Clinton, historic turnout which favors Democrats. There was a poll released less than a week before the election saying that Walker was up by 53-47. I knew that was wrong. It was ridiculous. It didn't fit the circumstances. The opposite would have made more sense. And indeed, when it all went down and it turned out that Walker won, I invited a brilliant statistician by the name of Richard Charnin to study the situation with me, where Charnin has published two books on the theft of election using voting machines. And Charnin discovered that this election, like four other previous elections in Wisconsin, had been stolen using electronic voting machines. Where one of the most obvious proofs was the following. Milwaukee County is a bastion of Democratic support. And as I have already remarked, we had an historic turnout, which traditionally favors Democrats overwhelmingly. And yet in Milwaukee County, the greater the number of votes that were cast, the greater the percentage that went to the Republican candidate, Scott Walker. Now, that's just ridiculous. And indeed, it turned out that Charnin has been able to prove that Scott Walker's recall election was rigged to make Scott Walker the only governor who has survived a recall election. There were hundreds of thousands of Wisconsin citizens down at the state capitol protesting when he cracked down on public unions. I mean, this man was about as despised as any political candidate in the history of Wisconsin. There was a Supreme Court contest between a guy named Prosser and a woman named Kloppenburg, highly qualified, where Prosser was put into office because of a stolen election. I've already mentioned the Mary Burke, Scott Walker contest. Well, when we had the primary here in Wisconsin, it happened again where there was a poll put out. I mean, look. Trump had been leading by at least 10 points here. And then right before the election, the Marquette School of Law, which had given us the phony poll results about Walker leading Burke by 53-47, reported that Trump was now trailing Cruz by 10 points. I mean, that's a manifest absurdity again. As a 20-point shift in like 10 days, they don't happen. And it was ridiculous. And I was convinced it was fraudulent. Indeed, I was that very day, which, as I recall, was the 5th of April. I was actually in the studio of the talk show host, Mitch Hank, at 9 a.m. to 9:30, explaining that the election was rigged and what was going to come of it, and that they were doing this to put Cruz ahead of Trump, to slow down Trump, that they were going to minimize Bernie's margin over Hillary, which they did to about 10 points, and to put a bim bat on the Supreme Court, someone whom Scott Walker had appointed to three different judicial appointments in three successive years, where if they don't have a close personal relationship, none of it makes any sense. She was highly unqualified and had been exposed for writing grotesque columns while an undergraduate at Marquette, assailing gays and lesbians and talking about AIDS as the politically correct disease to have because of the attention it would get. I mean, it was a disgrace. At that point in time, she had a 75% disapproval rating. So you think they're going to turn around and elect her to the Supreme Court, again going against Joanne Kloppenberg, highly qualified? They had to rig it to make sure it would come out right. Now, here's the way it actually is, if you look at slide number 14, that Trump actually has a 15 or 16 point lead. The latest poll just reported on television shortly before I came on the air reaffirms it. Here's Trump leading 49 to 34. I believe this is an accurate poll. But the fact that they put out this fantasy poll that has no basis. I mean, how can you have polls so wildly divergent? There's a 30-point spread between these two polls. It means one of them is completely fantastic. Other polls have shown Trump with a consistent, significant lead. So what they're doing is salting the mind by planting the idea that Cruz could have a win so that when they manipulate the polls, you say, oh, gee, I guess that poll that we thought was an outlier actually had it right. Well, they didn't have it right. They rigged the election. That's what's happening here. Look at slide number 15. This is what we had in Wisconsin right up to the time that Trump versus Cruz took place here. There are 8 districts in Wisconsin, and this poll had many, many more, like 8 times as many participants as the Marquette School of Law poll that had something like 947 participants to give the skewed result of Trump being 10 points behind Cruz. Here's the way it actually was. District 1, Trump 62 to Cruz 37. District 2, Trump 62, Cruz 37. District 3, Trump 63, Cruz 36. 4, 52 to 47. 5, 53 to 46. 6, 57 to 43. 7, 66 to 33. 8, 62 to 37. There was no way Trump was going to lose here. And to create a beard, a disguise, a camouflage, they claimed that right-wing talk show hosts here had ganged up against Trump and caused him to lose. Well, that's ridiculous. Trump supporters don't give a damn what anyone else says. They know the man, the quality, what he represents, and they're mad as hell and they aren't going to take it anymore. So that was just a fig leaf. It was ridiculous. It was absurd. I have tried to get Wisconsin figures, including the devil's advocates, Mitch Hank, and others, including the Capital Times and the Wisconsin State Journal, to pursue this. It's blatant. The evidence is overwhelming. And they just appear to be too politically correct to be willing to acknowledge that these elections have been stolen in Wisconsin, which, of course, is a guarantee. They're going to continue to be stolen, where the legislature has been passing absurd policies that they would never pass. Do they feel their own seats would ever be in jeopardy? They have the security of knowing the elections are rigged in Wisconsin. And here in slide number 16, we have further confirmation from the governor of Arizona reporting that there was vote fraud in Arizona too, that she was cheated. The people of Arizona were cheated. Trump delegates were cheated. People have got to understand, she was calling for a return to paper ballots, which is completely appropriate, getting rid of these electronic voting machines. Here's yet another story about the theft of elections, in this case in Chicago, in slide number 17, this wonderful discussion on Russia Today was talking about how the board that reviews elections was being presented with one proof after another of the rigging of the elections taking place, and they were all dismissing it on the grounds that, well, these people weren't the experts, therefore, when it was simple addition, as the host was pointing out, completely ridiculous. Now, what else can we expect? Look at slide number 18. Demonstrators storm California GOP convention to protest Trump. It turns out many of them were paid to do this. It's not the first time. And yet we had a commentator on a national network acknowledging that they were paid, but saying she didn't see anything wrong with it. How stupid is that? We're allowing our public discourse to be polluted by interveners who are paying, and this is not the first time. Look at slide number 19. It turns out that right here in Janesville, which is only about 20 miles south of where I reside as I speak to you now, we had a whole group of protesters for Trump when he gave his first speech here in Wisconsin who were being paid $15 an hour. This is completely ridiculous. Shuttle buses, parking, signs, hourly pay available, $15 an hour due to economic inequality. Meet at 3300 West Trip Road, Janesville, Wisconsin, 53548 for pre-protest instructions and to get your time card. Here's another, even more outrageous, in slide number 20. This is from Arizona, where they actually created a barrier on the highway. Trump protester speaks, I was paid $3,500 to protest Trump's rally. And when you get down into the nitty gritty, it turns out those who were paying him appear to have been from Hillary Clinton's campaign. He was told by the old women in their 60s that if he was asked what happened, he should start talking enthusiastically about Bernie Sanders. This is one more sign of the degree of corruption of Hillary Clinton. Completely disgusting. Very thematic with our next story, which comes from Robert Perry, number 21, one of our nation's best investigative journalists. Is Hillary Clinton honest? Where he's not talking about the number of true sentences she has in her speeches, where she has a relatively high truth frequency rating, but more profound forms of corruption. Allow me to offer some illustrations. Slide number 22. There's been a Benghazi breakthrough now, and it turns out the newly obtained emails lead directly to the White House, where they were very concerned that the Benghazi fiasco that led to the death of Ambassador Chris Stevenson not be regarded as a policy failure of the Obama administration, and where instructions were given to claim that it was precipitated by the ridiculous little trailer, Innocence of Muslims, that casts aspersions upon the Prophet Muhammad. That upset people who are Muslim, of course, but it had nothing to do with what happened in Benghazi. So here's Hillary participating in lies. She spent 11 hours before the Benghazi committee deflecting questions and giving one lie after another. The woman is profoundly corrupt. Here's someone else who thinks so, too. Slide number 23. Turns out that Seymour Hersh explains he's discovered that Hillary approved sending sarin gas from Libya to the Syrian rebels. This would be the gas that was used to create the brouhaha that was going to entitle Barack Obama to start lobbing cruise missiles into Syria. Hillary was involved in that, too. Fortunately, the Russians intervened with a 50-page dossier that demonstrated that Assad had nothing to do with it, that it was by the rebels, where Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia appears to have had a role. It's very interesting, by the way, that 2 days after 9/11, George W. Bush entertained Prince Bandar in the White House, and they sat together on the balcony and smoked cigars because of the great triumph they had helped to orchestrate, known as 9/11. Completely disgusting. Here's another, slide number 24. Why black people should reconsider their support for Hillary Clinton. This is a brilliant article that goes through one policy decision after another where Clinton's desire to reform, welfare as we know it, to introduce new crime laws and all that, have severely adverse effects upon black communities and black families in the United States, and has led to the highest incarceration rate of blacks in American history. That is compliments of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. They need to get their facts straight and figure out who their real friends are, because Hillary Clinton and Bill are not friends of black Americans. We've had the most interesting twist of events in slide number 25, when John Boehner, who was questioned at Stanford University, described Ted Cruz as Lucifer in the flesh. They said, now don't hold back. Don't hold back, John. He went on to say that Cruz was the most difficult SOB. He spelled it out, SOB he'd ever had to work with. And there are, you know, hundreds of others in Washington who feel exactly the same. Here's yet another fascinating revelation in slide number 26. Ted's wife, Heidi, said that Ted is an immigrant. During a speech she gave, she talked about Ted being an immigrant, Ted being Hispanic, which means, of course, he's not a natural born citizen. So that, in fact, he's not qualified to be president of the United States. That came from the man's own wife, Heidi, and when she realized what a goof she had made, what a gaffe, she said she misspoke. How can the wife misspoke about the status of her own husband and whether or not he's an immigrant, which means he's not natural born, which means he's not qualified to run for president of the United States? And look at the next slide, number 27. In fact, this is the first mainstream newspaper to say that Cruz is ineligible. It is the Arizona Republic, a part of the USA Today network, came out Friday in their online edition saying that Calgary Ted Cruz is not eligible to run for president of the United States. Indeed, the analysis they provide even raises questions whether the junior senator is even qualified to hold a seat in the United States Senate. Very significant development. This is going to get around. Now, here, this may be a contributing factor to the next slide, the next story, which is that the support for Cruz among the delegates is significantly softening. I think many are realizing that Cruz is not really that strong a candidate and that Donald Trump is providing convincing wins, that the Donald is bringing in, blue-collar Democrats and independents by the millions. He has acquired the largest vote total of any candidate in American history, even surpassing Mitt Romney of 2012 by a considerable margin. And, of course, he's going to earn more. So delegates are now asking themselves whether, you know, it isn't maybe a better idea to start thinking about supporting Trump rather than going down with Titanic Ted Cruz. Here's slide number 29 is an excellent distillation of top 10 reasons to support Trump. We waited 53 years for this kind of honesty from Dave Hodges, who publishes The Common Sense Show. Dave Hodges is a very perceptive, very smart guy. He's been all over Jade Helm 15, and he's now reporting on Jade Helm 16. Where I've explained in the past that 15 appeared to be a pilot project, a beta test, as it were, to see how far they could go, closing the Walmarts, converting them into command and control centers. This man is nobody's fool. And look at some of the quotes he has from Donald Trump in slide number 30. Americans, politicians are bought and paid for by the special interests. The politicians need the money to get reelected. They're not going to do what's right for you because, of course, you know, they're bought and paid for. And he adds that Trump should be careful because it was this kind of honesty that got JFK taken out. The wall is going to be so big and effective that when I'm gone, they will name it after me. He adds, Trump is correct that when you let off the books workers into the country, they lower the wage structure for millions of American citizens. Number three. People are concerned about taking in Syrian refugees. However, we do not know where they come from and what their intentions are, and they are completely undocumented. My God, given how much Muslims have been held responsible for major catastrophes in this country, according to the official reports, Muslims were responsible for 9/11. Muslims were responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing. Muslims were responsible for San Bernardino. Muslims were responsible for Charlie Hebdo. Muslims were responsible for Paris. ISIS is supposed to be bad Muslims. Iran is supposed to be run by bad Muslims. And, of course, Muslim hordes are invading Europe and committing all kinds of atrocities, including an astronomical number of rapes. Now, most of those stories, apart from the last, I regard as being false or at least grossly exaggerated. Iran, as I've mentioned before, is a peace-loving country. And the idea of demonizing Iran is simply fantastic. But the fact is that Donald has a receptive audience when he suggests we need to hold off on the immigration of Muslims into this country until we figure out what's going on here. Here's another four. Obama has brought so much disrespect to the office of the president that when he lands on Air Force One, there's nobody of note to greet him. That's what we recently saw in Saudi Arabia and in Cuba. I will force foreign leaders to respect me, and if they don't respect me, they will fear me. Obama and his special interest friends are the reason why the world walks all over us. Number five, the new omnibus bill passed by Congress and supported by Obama funds Syrian refugees and undocumented immigrants for our southern border. As Dave Hodges adds, no money for Americans, only for foreign nationals illegally coming into our country. And think now about a story I'm going to report at the end where Jerry Brown is now going to let millions of illegal aliens participate in voting in California. Here are more. Number six, Americans are not angry people, but we are angry at a system that does not allow us to achieve anything. Since 1980, in real dollars, Americans are working 20% longer for 20% less. And where is that money going? It's going to the special interests who have never made more money at our expense. Hodges adds, since the advent of NAFTA, we've witnessed the greatest wealth transfer in the history of the world. And of course, NAFTA has been a principal target of both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Number seven, Hillary wanted to go into Libya. Ask yourself, who has the oil? It is ISIS. We do not hit ISIS, and our government is allowing them to take what they want. Dark, shadowy banking forces are supporting ISIS. We don't hit the refineries because we don't want to cause environmental damage. So we let ISIS continue what they're doing. Well, the fact of the matter is, as I have been able to establish, ISIS was created by the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2012 to put more pressure on the Assad government and to create an opening for the expansion of Israel to become the greater Israel, to which it has already aspired, dominating the region from the Tigris, Euphrates to the Nile. We have photographs. We not only have the documents from the Defense Intelligence Agency obtained by Judicial Watch, we have photographs of ISIS members sporting U.S. Army tattoos. The files of an aide to Senator John McCain have been hacked and show the videotaping of the fake beheading videos on sound stages in Tel Aviv or in Hollywood. There's much more, including that Iraqi army forces shot down two UK cargo planes delivering supplies to ISIS. And a week later, Iraqi popular forces shot down an American helicopter doing the same. ISIS is our creation, and many drone pilots are leaving the military in droves because they aren't allowed to attack ISIS. Here's another, number eight. Obama will fly a 747 to Hawaii to play golf and then talk to us about global warming. Here, of course, he's alluding to the squandering of resources to fly a giant plane all the way across the country, all the way halfway across the Pacific to Hawaii in order for the president to play golf. What a hypocritical behavior. Number nine, I campaign for votes and win millions and crush my opponents in the process. Meanwhile, the establishment buys delegates in both parties. The political system in this country is corrupt. The elections are corrupt. And indeed, I've been documenting this with a theft in elections that we have discovered in Wisconsin, I suspect tomorrow in Indiana, and during a conversation I had with Jim Condit, who is running for John Boehner's old seat in Cincinnati. Both the Cruz election in Texas and Kasich in Ohio were manufactured by the use of electronic voting machines. Everyone in Texas was talking about Donald Trump, and they were both promoted in order to slow down the Trump train, not because they're loved or admired in their own states. Number 10, free trade agreements are killing the American people. They have cost us tens of millions of American jobs. When I am president, I will see that every American corporation that relocates overseas for cheap labor will pay a 35% tax to bring that product back into our country. Manufacturing will return, jobs will return, and prosperity will return. Criminal Hillary will continue this practice pursued by Obama with NAFTA and the TPP. Criminal Hillary does not care about you, and if she is elected, things will only get worse. I have no doubt about it. And it turns out there are all kinds of triggers in the TPP, one of the most stunning being this, that it creates a board of corporate attorneys that have the right to override the laws and statutes of any nation, of any of the 14 Pacific Rim nations that are encompassed thereby, including the Constitution of the United States, which means that once we have TPP, the United States will have lost its own sovereignty. Tragic, but that's what the TPP represents. Bear in mind, it is a monster that imposes corporations as running the world. And remember, as Mussolini observed, fascism can be defined as the merge of big business with big government. It can equally be well known as corporatism. Those who are promoting these trade agreements are the fascists. Those who are opposing them are the anti-fascists. The consequences should be obvious. Bernie and Donald are opposing these fascistic programs that put corporations in charge of the world. Slide number 32 is significant because it reflects that the GOP elites are becoming resigned to the idea that Donald is going to be their nominee, that it's going to be impossible for Cruz to stop him, that Donald's bringing millions of new voters into the Republican Party, and that what they're going to have to undergo is a kind of a reformulation, a reformatting of the Republican Party, but where they're liable to win a lot of very powerful victories politically with all the newcomers by the millions that Donald is bringing in. Look at the next, slide number 33. This was published by my colleague Kevin Barrett. Will Hillary lose to Donald Trump? Unless, of course, the fix is in. I think this is exactly right, that once the truth comes out about Hillary, and there's a whole lot for the country to learn, and the Donald is not going to be hesitant about dishing the dirt, where we get some samples, for example, from Roger Stone in his book, The Clintons' War on Women, which explains how Bill was a serial abuser of women's and Hillary was a facilitator. Bill Clinton, many don't understand, was kicked out of Oxford because he raped a fellow student. And Hillary went after women who tried to protest their abuse at the hands of her husband, hammers and tongs. That's going to come out. It's already there in the book, but it's going to be translated into easily digestible bites in the form of campaign commercials, I have no doubt. Slide number 34, again, reflects that here we had a prominent political commentator on the Morning Joe telling Joe Scarborough that he believes Donald Trump could beat Hillary and win the general election. I'm going to say this out loud. I actually think this guy is going to win. Deutsch told a surprise Joe Scarborough on Friday's podcast. Obviously, the woman problem, the Hispanic problem, the demographics are very against him. Having said that, though, Trump voters on the right are so sticky. They're not going everywhere, anywhere. Everyone is voting for Hillary. They say half-heartedly, well, I guess Hillary, he said of Trump and Clinton supporters. Number two, he could go to the left and right of Hillary. He can pretty much put a portfolio of issues together that he's behind. Hillary is a hawk. Hillary is a neocon. She's never met a war she didn't like. She was responsible for the invasion of Libya and the destruction of that near-idyllic society. She told a group at Dartmouth last year that if she became president, she would bomb Iran into oblivion. She is a absolutely bloodthirsty individual, deceptive in her manner, that the American people are going to learn more and more about. Here in slide number 35, we get a further reflection about the Bernie nation can't get behind Hillary. And I think there are good reasons for it. Actually, Bernie has much more in common with Donald Trump in terms of policy issues than he has with Hillary Clinton. Look at the next now, slide number 36, the very idea of some kind of alliance between the Donald and Sanders was being poo-pooed on the opinion pages of the New York Times. But the attack that was taken by Charles M. Blow here really had more to do with socioeconomic status than anything else, suggesting that the Bernie supporters are better educated, upper middle class by and large. The Donald supporters, mostly blue collar, less well educated. But that doesn't mean they don't share a tremendous number of common issues. Look at slide number 37, for example. A Trump-Sanders independent ticket would win, many have observed. I've actually recommended it. I believe it's a brilliant idea. I think it would be absolutely unbeatable, very, very powerful. And why? What are some of the reasons for thinking so? Well, consider the next. These are commonalities between them. They both hate NAFTA, the TPP, and the PNTR with China. They both believe free trade causes American job losses. Their rhetoric and positions on trade are mirror images. Trump said about Sanders, "We both agree that we're getting ripped off by China, by Japan, by Mexico, by everyone we do business with." On NAFTA, Trump called it a disaster. Sanders said it has displaced a large number of jobs in the United States and is a significant contributor to the current crisis in U.S. manufacturing. Countless media outlets lumped their trade policies together already with headlines like Trump and Sanders common cause. So this is a natural pairing. Foreign policy. They're both non-interventionists who think the war in Iraq was a mistake. Trump has said the war was one of the worst decisions in the history of the country. Sanders has said on the most important issue of our time, I was right. Hillary Clinton was wrong. While Trump has a tougher appearance than Sanders on policy, if you go region by region, they are more similar than any two other candidates who ran in 2016. Taxing the wealthy. Everyone knows Sanders has said the wealthiest and large corporation will pay when I'm president. But Trump's rhetoric is nearly the same. He said he wants to raise taxes on rich people like me, and the hedge fund people make a lot of money and they pay very little tax. While Trump's latest plan doesn't back up these statements, his plan is clearly geared toward winning the GOP primary, not his core beliefs. And I believe another example is what he had to say at AIPAC, where it seems to me his actual core beliefs involve him working on the toughest deal he'd ever have to make between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I do not believe he is going to be a lapdog of Israel, as has been true of so many of his predecessors, and where Cynthia McKinney, of course, revealed recently that when new members of Congress arrive in Washington, they're asked to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel ahead of those of the United States. If they do not do that, they can expect to find themselves confronted with a well-financed opponent in the next election, or perhaps even be redistricted out of office. Something will happen. It takes great courage to stand up against it. I believe Donald Trump is precisely the guy who would never kowtow to any form of intimidation of that kind. Here's another, government paying for college. We all know about Sanders' free college plan, but Trump has also said, well, the only way you can do it, make college affordable, is you have to start some governmental program, and you have governmental programs right now. So Trump is talking about expanding them, developing them, funding them more amply, protecting entitlement programs. Trump said, you know, Paul Ryan wants to knock out Social Security, knock it down, way down. He wants to knock Medicare way down. I'm not going to cut it, and I'm not going to raise ages. Sanders has said the chain CPI that Congressman Ryan supports is nothing less than a massive cut in benefits for Social Security. Everyone in Washington knows that it's easy to fund Social Security by simply raising the cap on the level of income that is taxed to support the program. It's effortless. It's obvious. And I am personally convinced that when Trump reviews the bidding on how to provide a suitable health program for the American people, that he will discover on a cost efficiency basis that the Sanders proposal to expand Medicare is the right way to go. So I expect that the Donald is, in fact, ultimately going to adopt Bernie's proposal for single-payer Medicare for All as his health care program. And Medicare, of course, was originally designed to be expanded to every member of our society, where the bureaucracy for its provision is already in place. We know very well that governments can provide programs like this with like a 2% overhead. And then if it's privatized, it jumps to 12% because of the profit margin government isn't seeking to acquire. I would also add here another issue on which they are 100% in agreement is the Second Amendment. Both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are strong supporters of the Second Amendment. Hillary Clinton, like Barack Obama, is seeking to deprive us of our rights to own weapons under the Second Amendment. Hillary has been appealing to the Sandy Hook parents for support there for emotional drive, which is completely inappropriate because Hillary has to know, like the rest of the world is gradually learning, that Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax. It was a two-day FEMA drill where I published about it and even included the FEMA manual for a rehearsal on the 13th, going live on the 14th, and the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, 2015, which is 425 pages with 250 photographs, 13 contributors, including a half a dozen PhD, current or retired college professors who blow the story out of the water because the school was closed by 2008. In 2012, look at the photographs. It's not compliant with Americans for Disability state or federal requirements. That's because it was a non-functioning school long since abandoned. Two final stories. Here on number 39, as I anticipated, Jerry Brown, also known as Governor Moonbeam, has signed a new voter law that allows illegal aliens to vote in California. This appears to me to be an effort to put a couple of million anti-Trump voters on the California roster because illegal aliens in California are allowed to have driver's licenses, and now they're being automatically registered to vote. I mean, what an absurdity is this? The Secretary of State said that citizens should have the right to vote, but the point is they are not citizens of California. They are illegal aliens, thanks to Jerry Brown. Obvious. And finally, the last, at the convention, if it gets there, we can expect electronic voting to play a role again because they're planning to use it to manipulate the outcome to suit the interests of the Republican Party. Donald has to win it outright. I'm predicting they're going to steal the election tomorrow in Indiana. But look what happened after Wisconsin. He came back with a triumph in New York and then followed up with a most impressive political victory in five states in the East that I think we have ever seen in modern political history. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Stand by for a very special program featuring an unusual set of issues. We'll be right back.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Edward III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horne, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder. We'll be right back.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen in.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Go, Gary. Hey, welcome to the new deal. Welcome to the real deal. The new JFK show with Jim Fetzer, Gary King, Larry Rivera, Don Fox, and our special guest tonight, Ralph Sinque. We have a very special topic tonight that's very much in the news. Rafael Cruz and the latest developments on Ted Cruz's withdrawal from the GOP presidential race based on Donald Trump's latest comments on Lee Oswald and Rafael Cruz being together down at in front of the Trade Mart in New Orleans in 1963. And Jim, it's been an incredible 24 hours in the last for the last couple of days. what's your take on all of this?
Larry, it's been unbelievable. Actually, believe it or not, the last hour I just gave a summary of what's been going on politically and laid the background for what we're going to discuss here in greater detail. So I'm having trouble getting in. Why don't you go right ahead and start talking about it and I'll join in?
Well, we mentioned in our last show about the National Enquirer article that came out in the tabloid, supermarket tabloid, a couple of weeks ago, and we have up on our screen a copy of the cover of the National Enquirer, and this made headlines around the world, Jim, and obviously this touched a very raw nerve in the Ted Cruz camp. Apparently, this happened, this was announced when Donald Trump announced this on exactly yesterday, the day of the Indiana primary, and Ted Cruz admits that he wasn't aware and he wasn't expecting this type of news to come out from the Donald Trump camp, and that it took him by surprise. And we're going to talk about a lot of things, especially what I call the crown jewel. And I'm sure Jim will be able to give us a little bit more information on what the crown jewel means regarding some of the secrets that are kept over in Langley. But it doesn't surprise anybody that this happened out of the blue when Ted Cruz had vowed to fight to the finish all the way to the end here, and then all of a sudden, you know, this happens, and you know, it's sort of like kind of strange to me, Jim.
Well, I have a conjecture about this, Larry, which is very unflattering to the Cruz family, but I believe that this investigator there in Indiana who lost his life have been publishing about the Cruz family, about the unusual family history. And I would not be surprised if Rafael had a very negative reaction to that, felt it was a threat to his entire, his son's campaign for office, and acted the way he would have acted in the old days by taking him out. I mean, this guy was found dead in a stairway. And there's no way, you know, it wasn't a suicide. Wayne Madsen has written about it. We now have major articles by Stu Webb, a very famous federal whistleblower, by Wayne Madsen, and even by this fellow who winds up dead. And I'm just afraid it's all confirmation that Rafael Cruz was exactly the person we have taken him to be, who was there in Dealey Plaza with Lee, where Chauncey Marvin Holt described, explained that everyone who was there that day was involved in Operation Mongoose.
You mean at the Trade Mart?
At the Trade Mart.
Yeah, that was in the summer of 1963, and Judy Baker has a lot of information about that, and we're going to be discussing that tonight also. And this intrigues me, Jim, because the background, going back to Cuba, of the Cruz family is also very very intriguing in its own right. And and some of this sort of seems to evolve into what we would call political favors later on.
Yes.
In what Ted Cruz became later on, a powerful senator out of Texas, Jim.
I know, a powerful senator. It appears that Rafael was able to tap into the Bush family to get Ted into Princeton as an undergraduate in return for his past performance of services for them. So this whole thing is very, very murky and profoundly disturbing. And I'm very much inclined to believe that he got out because he was worried. He wanted to protect his father and that not more have more light shed upon this aspect of his history. But where I just say it wouldn't surprise me at all if Rafael had had a hand in taking out the student Gary Welsh, W-E-L-S-H, who had been publishing about the murky family history and dredging up issues that I'm certain not only Ted, but even more so Rafael, did not want brought to public attention.
Well, going back a little bit further, Jim, there's a lot of information going around the web and around the internet that Rafael Cruz's recruitment at the University of Texas might have been also some kind of a favor or some kind of setting up there, you know, from some kind of agency or something, where later on, you know, he would be developed into some kind of agent or something like that. You know, it's a story that keeps unfolding, I think, on a daily basis, you know, and a lot of people weighing in, a lot of people, you know, uncovering new information and so on and so forth. So I think everybody should stay tuned on this.
Oh, I agree. And we've got to pursue it. And Ralph, of course, has published several blogs that seem to be totally fitting and appropriate. And I know Gary has a lengthy letter from Judith Baker. Maybe he can read a good part of it after we talk about the photograph in question, which, of course, is the very next slide if you're prepared to turn to it, Larry.
Yeah, this is the one that hit the fan, so to speak, when Wayne Manson let's remind our audience and our listeners that we were one of the first organizations here, one of the first groups to bring this out. Last month, I was looking at the files, and this happened at the beginning of April, where we even did some analysis on the facial characteristics of the man there holding the leaflets behind Lee Oswald, and where Chauncey Holt is in the same picture, the photograph, and we had already discussed this already. You know, it seems incredible, but this happened a month ago, Jim.
Yeah, cutting edge.
Yeah.
Well, what fascinates me is that in an uncropped version, you know, this has still been cropped on the left. We see the image that appears to be Michael Payne, who was, of course, the husband of Ruth Payne, both of whom were working for the CIA, where Ruth Payne arranged to get Lee Oswald a position in the Texas School Book Depository just 2 weeks before the motorcade, where the shorter fellow on the far right with his arms hanging down is Chauncey Marvin Holt, whom I got to know personally. I sent him this video documentary, JFK, The Assassination, The Cover-Up and Beyond, that runs, 3.5 hours. And when I discovered he was alive, because he'd sent a letter to the editor to the Fourth Decade. And he called me up like at 3:30 in the morning saying he'd been staying up all night watching it. And he thought I had it right, which I thought was tremendously flattering coming from a guy who actually had been a participant in the assassination, where I would meet him personally in California at a restaurant beneath the Rose Bowl, and where, you know, we got to know each other. Very, very fascinating guy. At one point, he was from a trapeze family. He was a painter, a forger, a counterfeiter. At one point, he was Meyer Lansky's accountant, believe it or not. But he was a contract agent for the CIA, who was instructed to prepare 15 sets of Foreign Secret Service credentials by his handler, Philip Twombly, when he was working at the Los Angeles Stamp and Stationery Store. He told me how the CIA has all these innocuous sounding proprietaries, you know. That one was interesting, Larry, because it was like five floors, and the first three were a legitimate business, and the top two was where they ran the CIA identification forging operation, where they prepared, for example, the Alec Heidel ID that Oswald had in New Orleans, and where the bottom three floors were a legitimate business, guess what, manufacturing police and sheriff's badges and identification. So if they needed a police or sheriff badge, they could not just get a fake one, they could get a real one for their agent to use. Now, Chauncey was very worried as to whether he was going to get the color code for the these pins the Secret Service agents wear that changed from assignment to assignment, but he did get them in time. He was instructed to go to Dealey Plaza and to leave these 15 sets of forged IDs in a red pickup truck that would be parked behind the grassy knoll, which is a parking lot used by the Dallas Police Department. But the truck wasn't there. So he wandered around Dealey Plaza, and he told me he saw more bad guys, more assassins, more mercenaries than you'd find at a Soldiers of Fortune convention. He went back, and the truck was there. He left the ID, and in the company of Charles Harrelson, the father of actor Woody Harrelson, who was a hitman for the mob, and a man he knew as Richard Montoya, but who was actually Charles Rogers, they headed to a boxcar down in the railway yard, which would appear to be locked, but would in fact not be. They climbed in and discovered it was full of explosives, weapons, and ammunition. I'm convinced, Larry, that if Lee hadn't worked out as the patsy, those guys were going to be fingered. They, of course, would be arrested and escorted through Dealey Plaza as the so-called three tramps. But it was all quite extraordinary, where the very first of the three was Charles Rogers, the second was Charles Harrelson, the third Chauncey Holt, where those identifications were not only made by Chauncey, but by Lewis Gibson, who was a forensic artist who worked for the Houston Police Department. Where she even had the benefit of Chauncey actually coming in for her to examine his features, and she confirmed that the IDs of those three tramps were as I've described. We've had whole books published to give false information to the public about their identity, such as by the LaFontaines, this piece of rubbish called Oswald Talked, one of the worst books ever on the assassination of JFK.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject briefly here, Jim, because you mentioned Chauncey Holt, and we have discussed before that he had mentioned that the CIA had a safe house in Acapulco. But now, with the new revelations of Rafael Cruz, him going to Calgary, the Great White North, what is known as, you know, Canada, where, you know, who would have gone, thought of going chasing down, you know, some of these Cubans up there in Calgary? You know, I thought that was a brilliant idea, a brilliant move, you know, to get these Cubans that were involved with Oswald down in New Orleans at that time, to get them out of the way and out of the picture. I thought that was a brilliant move, you know, and it sort of falls into place, you know, with what Chauncey Holt has told us, you know, regarding what happened to all those operatives, you know, after the assassination, where they were treated to, you know, a couple of months or even more or even longer, you know, of sun and fun, you know, down in Acapulco after the assassination, you know. So, you know, everything is really, really important, you know, in bringing out, you know, a lot of the operation about, you know, how this
works. I believe that safe house, Chauncey told me, was owned by George Ball, who was one of the Warren Commissioners.
That's right.
This is how tight it was, the collusion between the assassins and the Warren Commission staff.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, 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 yes. And also, you mentioned Lewis Gibson, you know, and I just wanted to briefly mention that.
I'm on the air right now. I'll have to call you back.
We have her evaluate our work on the man in the doorway with the overlays, and that promises to be, something that we've been really looking forward to. So, you know, stay tuned on that one also.
Well, of course, as you've reminded everyone, we did already a study about the identity of Rafael Cruz using other photographs. Now we have so many more. Ralph has been instrumental in getting quite a few out on his blog. And I'm sorry to say that he called me just a few minutes ago to say that their internet was down, that electricity's been out for like 3 hours. And he was kind of shocked when I suggested that it might be to make sure he wouldn't come on the show today. I don't think this kind of thought has ever passed his mind. But Chance and I can attest, we get knocked off all the time. Chance has had all his files wiped. They took off the whole channel they took down. I mean, the government is not happy with what we do here on The Real Deal.
Well, you know, it goes back to the crown jewel, Jim. You know, I think, you know what I'm talking about, you know. So let's move on to the next slide here.
Sure. I think it's excellent that we have more photographs of Rafael Cruz. And indeed, you know, there are dozens. I have one of Ralph's blogs here, and it just goes on and on.
Yeah.
And on and, yeah. On, and yeah. On. I mean, this is fantastic. I just want to say what great work Ralph has been doing. And I wanted to recognize that by featuring him on the show here tonight. But it appears that they were going to make sure that didn't happen. Ralph, of course, can be a very dogged and determined in ferreting things out. He was the key to identifying the men in the doorway, pointing out to me that it wasn't the face that mattered, but the height, the weight, the build, the clothing, the shirt, the T-shirt, where doorman and Billy Lovelady are so very, very different, where even Billy himself said he was 2 to 3 inches shorter and 15 to 20 pounds heavier. And, of course, he was there wearing a red and white vertically striped short sleeve shirt. I mean, Larry, can you believe the amount of resistance we've had to the obvious, namely that the doorman was Lee Oswald, who just happened to have the same height, weight, build, shirt, T-shirt as Lee Oswald when he was arrested? I mean, you know, this isn't really rocket science. But when you have 90% of the community that are working the other side of the street, what you get is this defiant resistance to evidence where they disabuse logic and proof. They don't care because they have a mission to defeat the truth.
Well, especially when you have the dean of deception, who we discussed last week thoroughly. We did a show on that with a lot of visuals and a lot of information and a lot of slides, you know, that pointed towards, you know, very dubious.
Larry, it's embarrassing the role of Robert Groden in this community. He and Josiah Thompson have been two of the leaders of the band, the opposition to the truth being advanced and made available to the public. It's just shocking when you look at the history of the JFK research community. It is so infested with vipers and snakes and agents of disinformation.
And they hold the keys to two of the most important, if not the most important, issues that we have discussed over the years, which are the alteration of the Zapruder film and the man in the doorway, where without any credentials whatsoever, where we have had John Costella, PhD in optics and photography analysis, done his incredible work. We have had Roy Schaefer doing his work, you know, on the removal of frames and the blink rates of the limo, of the JFK limo, and the alterations therein, and the work of Douglas Horn. You know, I mean, how can anybody refute the work of these
people? I know.
Who conclusively have proven that the Zapruder film has been altered, yet these two people, you know, insist that the Zapruder film is a quote-unquote time clock of the assassination, which we know it is not.
Josiah Thompson actually said that the Zapruder film is the closest thing we have to absolute truth about the death of JFK. I mean, how absurd can you get?
Yeah, and the man in the doorway issue, which is something that we have already proven time and again, has been Lee Oswald. And stay tuned, because we have a lot of new people coming on board, you know, with the overlay technology and the analysis, and it's going to be a very exciting time, you know, here, but with before the 22nd of November.
Right.
Observing the 53rd anniversary, and we can go on to the next slide, which shows.
If we get Gary back, I'd like for him to read that letter from Judith Baker, since it fits here so appropriately in relation to the photograph.
We have it in later slides, Jim. So.
Okay. If it's in the slides, go for it, Gary.
Yeah. And
Gary, go ahead.
This is the actual handbill. The actual. Flyer that was being, which is seen in the hands of not only Lee Oswald, but what we call the trademark man, which we now, even as speculative as it may be, you know, but looks like a lot of people have already determined that this might be Rafael Cruz, and it's very interesting, because I received an email recently from Carlos Quiroga, of all people, and he was mocking what we were presenting here, saying that he actually had these in his hands, because we all know that Carlos Quiroga went to visit Lee Oswald at his apartment in New Orleans at the time. And if you read Lee and Me, Judy's book, fantastic book, where she describes how Lee believed that this Quiroga guy was actually a pro-Castro agent.
Yeah.
And it's going to be discussed when Gary reads. So we have here on that. But just to us, you know, set this
Chance. If Chance could go back to slide number two momentarily, there's a point I'd like to make that I don't believe I made already, which is this. Chauncey Marvin Holt said everyone there that day was working for Operation Mongoose.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So you got a whole bunch of ops there working for the government, and they're all anti-Castro Cubans. And here's Lee Oswald giving out leaflets that are supposed to create the false impression that he's a pro-Castro communist sympathizer, when everyone he's associated with is anti-Castro. And this is what, of course, the agency calls sheep dipping to create the false persona.
Exactly.
Would be then used, you know, in implicating him for the death of JFK.
Exactly. So there's two issues here. Either he was being sheep dipped, or he was there posing as, you know, as an agent, you know, pro Castro, you know, where all these double agents and everything are in all this game, spy game is being played out there in New Orleans. But I wanted to point out that something that nobody ever really talks about, you know, the Japanese guy who is in the akimbo pose there, behind Lee Oswald, you know, that's always.
Yeah.
It's always been a mystery here, Jim. You know, not very many people have ever, you know, done any serious research on what that guy was doing there or what role he was fulfilling there. And that's still remains a mystery as far as I'm concerned, you know, with this photograph here.
Yeah, we don't have ID on everyone here. I mean, we got Michael Payne, Lee Oswald, Rafael Cruz, Chauncey Marvin Holt. The one guy here, we have a note there, Leroy Young, who is a pilot.
Right.
Then we got this Belcher. What is it?
Belcher. Yeah.
Bud Belcher. So we have a lot of IDs. We don't have the guy with his back to us, do we, or the one beside?
No. He looks like he's wearing glasses. Yeah, and the other guy over there, you know, it seems like, you know, like a spook reunion there.
really. Well, let's go forward then, since we're going to work our way up to Judith's letter. I guess we're on slide number five here, which simply dumbfounded me when Ralph pointed out that Raphael appears to be in this photograph, because, Larry, I put this photograph on the cover of Assassination Science.
That's right. It's called the Walter Sisko, S-I-S-C-O image photograph, and it was one of the best photographs, color photographs, taken that day of the motorcade. And it shows, like we discussed previously, you know, B.J. Martin and Hargis and Clint Hill and McIntyre.
And as Ralph has pointed out, in the upper right-hand corner there, You see, the two fellows with glasses were the second one. The taller appears to be Rafael Cruz, and the guy in front of him appears to be Antonio Vesiana, who is the founder of Alpha 66, one of the most vicious of all of the anti-Castro organizations.
Yeah, the next slide shows the same photograph circled with that area circled, so you can go ahead and do that. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, you got circled Rafael Cruz. But, you know, the other photograph he has of Antonio, I think that indeed that is the younger Antonio Vienza. How is it pronounced, Larry? Vesiana?
Vesiana.
He is a nasty piece of work. I mean, this Alpha 66 did assassinations, bombings, all kinds of sabotage. Bad group.
Yeah.
I was once doing an interview with a reporter in South Florida, Larry. You're going to enjoy this. And I was talking about how our research had led back to, you know, groups like Operation 40 and Alpha 66. And he said, well, these are my people. Because we were broadcasting right into Little Havana. And I said, yes, that's right. You know, yeah. And we never got a peep of protest. No one ever called to deny it, to say they'd been maligned or anything else, you know.
Yeah.
There was a reporter right there when I said Alpha 66. I said, these are my people.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing about the Cuban exile community is that it was quite disjointed at the time. They had multiple different organizations, each tugging towards each other's end. And that I think that's one of the reasons why there was difficulty in keeping track of each one of them, because you had the DRE, you had Alpha 66, you had the 25th of July movement or something like that, you know, and all these different organizations were trying to be reined in by the CIA at the time. So you know, it was quite a task there, you know. And then at the same time, you had all the Castro agents, you know, who had infiltrated some of these organizations, you know. So those days in the 1960s, before the assassination of JFK, where the anti-Castro movement was trying to get their island paradise back, with the backing of the CIA and the mafia, you know, and the big business interests, you know, it was quite an incredible point in history there. So that's.
Well, I was dumbfounded to. I should grab a copy of. Well, I've already shown it, I think, during the first hour of Assassination Science. I got this picture of Rafael Cruz right on the cover.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people have used this this photograph.
Let me grab it. I mean, just for the sake.
Yeah, this is called the Walter Sisko image. And another observation: if you look at the windshield there, right above Bill Greer, you'll see how nice and transparent it is. But then when you see the Zapruder film, you'll see how obscure it is. You know, where it seems to have been retouched here in the Zapruder film.
Here it is.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, it's the cover. That's right.
Look at that. Can you believe it? Right up here in the corner, we have Rafael Cruz and this Antonio Vesiana, who created Alpha 66. I would never have imagined a book. This was published in 1998.
Yeah. Well,
Did we lose Gary just at the point I thought we were going to call upon him to read?
Yeah, we've got.
Well, why don't you go ahead to Judith's letter? I mean, I can.
That's what's coming up now.
Yeah. Would you like to do the honors or shall I? Chance, can you give us slide number 7?
There you go.
Okay, this is from Judith Very Baker, who, of course, was Lee Oswald's girlfriend in New Orleans the summer before he came to Dallas, where Ruth Payne arranged for him to have a job at the school book depository, where they would bring the motorcade to the guy they were going to frame as the assassin, but where we proven he was actually in the doorway, and not only could not have been the lone gunman, but can't have even been one of the shooters, where I've identified six, and there may have been more. I'll read this. Rafael Cruz's parents were still in Cuba. For this reason, just as Carlos Origa was not fully trusted by Bannister's anti-Castro crusaders, neither was Cruz. Lee Oswald was involved in an anti-Castro sting that included passing out flyers about a fake Fair Play for Cuba cell that Lee Oswald organized to trap pro-Castroites in New Orleans. The cell never had a meeting, never existed except on paper. However, any Latino who took a flyer was photographed by Bannister's operatives. Lee distributed these on not two but four occasions, as described in my book, Me and Lee, which, of course, you can obtain actually on Amazon.com. Unlike my Sandy Hook book, it has not been banned. Cruz was assisting those who were trying to smoke out pro-Castro spies. Several who took these flyers either visited the shown addresses or called for more information. These individuals were confronted and in some cases had drugs planted on them, were beat up and deported back to Cuba. Pretty nasty and very effective. Lee Oswald was a useful patsy because he looked communist, looked pro-Castro. But he was one of ours and was betrayed and set up to cover the foul deeds of LBJ, the CIA, FBI, and rich oil barons and others who created a junta after getting JFK killed with the help of the mafia. How to handle? Cruz was present and held flyers, but he did not hand out any of the flyers. He was there to spy on pro-Castro activities. Now, Larry, in the videos, doesn't it appear that actually Rafael was handing out some of those flyers?
Yeah. And it seems like that. I think Chance has the actual video. You know, it doesn't seem that in the, I think it's only 11 seconds long, you know, that he is actually passing out any, but it seems like he has, you know, the what we would call the stash there, you know, ready to distribute to the ones that are passing out flyers. But regardless, it's pretty obvious that he's involved in the operation there.
Trump needs to know that the vast majority of Americans understand, thanks to the internet, that Lee Oswald didn't kill JFK. While I believe he does not dare say so, basically you should understand that Democrats, not Republicans, along with the CIA, Dulles, and LBJ, got JFK killed. Now here, she's talking about the Donald because he brought it up. He was the one who was chastising the media for not following up. And Larry, I thought that was totally appropriate. You know, there've been these big stories broken by the National Enquirer, including that Cruz had as many as five mistresses at a minimum that they didn't follow up on. And now this story about Cruz's father having been in New Orleans with Lee Oswald in front of the trademark, they didn't follow up on that either. I think Trump was perfectly entitled to raise a question, why not?
Well. Also, I've been looking at the reports today, and a lot of focus has been on how Rafael Cruz, how Donald Trump has been talking about how Rafael Cruz kept saying publicly that he was praying for something bad to happen to Donald Trump. And
Rafael Cruz was praying for something bad to happen to Donald Trump?
Yeah, absolutely. It played all day today on CNN. And
oh my God, Larry!
Yeah, and where you know Ralph Blitzer and all the people there at CNN, you know, kept insisting that the National Enquirer was not a reliable source, and that unless some of the mainstream media could confirm, and at the time, supposedly, and apparently, this CNN had been trying to confirm this information that had been published by the National Enquirer, and yet none of that information has come out. But yeah, Rafael Cruz, as a supposed ordained minister who doesn't even have a place of worship or anything like that, had been praying. I think this would fall into the category of Santeria, Jim. You know, the dark religion out of Cuba. You know, where and the voodoo type of thing.
Well, I wanted something bad to happen to Trump so his son would become the GOP nominee.
Right.
If there would ever be an easy candidate for Hillary to beat, it would be Ted Cruz. I mean, he's ridiculous. He's a caricature. He's such an ideologue. He's a totally implausible candidate. In fact, I can't believe it appears he was only propped up because the Bush family was actually operating to promote his interests in the background.
I was going to mention that. Traces back to the Bush Empire.
Let's go. Yeah, for which Raphael himself worked.
That's right.
Because we know George Herbert Walker Bush was arrested coming out of the Dell Techs, where he'd supervised a hit team, including an anti-Castro Cuban, Nestor Tony Escandro, who fired three shots at JFK, one of which hit him in the back of the head, another of which missed and hit a curb beam and injured a distant bystander, James Tague, and a third of which hit a chrome strip over the windshield. And then he was taken downtown and interrogated while his son W was left at loose ends. And we have photographs of W looking lost. And then later he's back in front of the book depository where he's photographed and where I spied him in Jesse Curry's JFK assassination file, a paperback published only by 7-Eleven stores after Jesse Curry resigned as chief of police in Dallas and went to work as their head of security. Let's go to page number eight, slide number eight, Chance, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to briefly interject here that adding to what I was talking about that I saw on CNN today also, that when they asked Donald Trump if he believed that that was Raphael Cruz, obviously he would have said, no, I don't believe that. I don't know of anybody, you know, in the right mind who would admit at this point in time in the campaign, you know, to admitting, hey, yeah, that's Raphael Cruz, and I believe that's him. You know, he would never. And the same as when they asked him a few months ago if he believed that Lee Oswald was, you know, was the lone assassin. He said, yeah, he's the lone assassin, you know. And I think this is all, you know, deception, you know, in the campaign where he's faking one way and he's really intending to go the other way.
Well, I think he's a very good bet for giving access to information about 9/11 as well. You know, if there's ever been a presidential candidate who has that capability, it seems to me it's the Donald. I'll continue with Judith. You can quote me. Cruz's father was involved in an anti-Castro sting operation in New Orleans, one of several, which also included Lee Harvey Oswald, who always said he was a patsy and denied killing Kennedy. The media says Cruz was involved with the Kennedy assassination by association with Oswald, but Oswald was falsely accused of killing Kennedy. The media, which is squirming right now because Trump is winning, lies about him, also lies about Oswald, hiding the truth. Roger Stone knows the truth, and the majority of the country has learned the truth on the internet. He doesn't have time, but Trump should know about book and also about mine, me and Lee. I'm not sure which book she means there. Maybe Ed Haslam's book about Dr. Mary's monkey.
Right, right.
I never knew Cruz's last name until asked to identify him, which I have done. In short, Cruz's father was involved in an anti-Castro sting operation.
Gary,
yeah, that's fine. You're back. Yeah. Taking care of the baby, that's a high priority, my friend. Shall I just continue to read this, Gary, or would you like to read part of it?
You're muted.
Gary, I'll just go ahead. Once again, let me stress that if he was working with Lee, as Lee told me he was, that means he was actually anti-Castro and was supporting the infiltration, identification of pro-Castroites and pro-Castro spies. In other words, he was a good guy from the point of view of the American government's official attitude. The odd lie about his actual height is a clue that this indeed was a CIA-sponsored person who was also being protected by participating in what looked like a pro-Castro demonstration. Details as to how this helped Lee are in me and Lee. Now, he changed an official record of his height to make it look that it was 6 feet when he was actually about the same height as Lee, about 5'9 or 5'10. And it's obvious that the number has been retyped in this document. So that's what she's alluding to. Chance, can we go to slide number 9?
Let me see. She's away.
Gary can go and pick. This is the last part of Judith's letter, yeah.
Oh, Gary's got the baby. That's wonderful.
Okay.
I've written to a person close to Trump telling him that Cruz, as was Lee Oswald, was involved in an anti-Castro sting operation to unearth pro-Castro spies in New Orleans. You can read about the operation and events. There were three in New Orleans and one in Dallas involving Lee Oswald. It was a CIA-sponsored assignment known to the FBI. In my book, Lee and Me, since the media has to keep stubbornly claiming that Lee killed Kennedy, which anyone who studies the matter or who reads Me and Lee or The Devil's Chessboard or one of the anti-LBJ books, they have to imply that Cruz's father was also anti-Kennedy, which is absurd and, of course, exposes the media's lies even more. Well, that's kind of funny. I've done a forensic study of Cruz's facial features. It's him, as the receding hairline is perfect, nose, bone structure of face. Please feel free to ask questions. But clearly, Cruz people, all these anti-Castro people were anti-Kennedy, Larry. I don't know why Judith added that sentence there. Let's go to slide number 10, by the way, because now we're getting into the nitty-gritty about this guy who appears to have been taken out.
Yes, Gary Welsh.
You want to talk about him?
Well, I was only made aware of this today, but it's stunning, you know, and consider, you know, the timing of this guy where he had also been one of the people bringing out the information on Cruz and then in Indiana.
Right.
On the day.
Right. Well, let me go ahead and read it. Gary Welsh, operator of Advance Indiana Political Blog. Police found Welsh's body laying in a stairway in his apartment complex in Indianapolis. The police report states, quote, police dispatch stated that the caller observed what they believed to be a person shot in the stairway of the building with a gun still laying on the scene. Person shot was confirmed and victim was pronounced deceased at the scene by medics, end quote. Welsh was a well-known lawyer and political commentator in Indiana who combated against the takeover of the state by religious fundamentalists and opposed well-connected GOP presidential candidates like Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio. Ironically, there was an Indianapolis connection to Gary Webb's death. The company he was targeting, ACS Incorporated, had as its vice president Stephen Goldsmith, a former mayor of Indianapolis. Indianapolis police may also be interested in Welsh's last email to this editor dated April 11, 2016. Let me just mention this ACS is Affiliated Computer Systems. And if you read up on Affiliated Computer Systems, they're involved in all kinds of covert activities, including thefts of election and the like. So it's very, I think this may be why they abandoned stealing Indiana for Cruz. There was just too much information here that could get to the heart of the matter about the theft of the election and his having been murdered. Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. Not only that, Jim, the main thing is what I said it over a month ago, that the establishment, as powerful as they are, cannot stop a landslide and they cannot stop a phenomenon. And Trump has become a phenomenon. And they did every trick in the book. They were successful with Ron Paul. However, they were not successful with Trump. So we have a bona fide phenomenon, which they're not able to create, nor are they able to control. So yes, they can fix elections, but not a landslide.
Well, I think that's a very nice point, Larry. Let's look, Gary, let's look at slide number 11.
12. Oh, yeah, 11, yeah, that's right, 11, yes, sorry.
Chant. Great catch on his Cruz's ties to Oswald in New Orleans. I always thought the odds were pretty good of the old man having ties to the CIA, if not Cruz's mother as well, since he was immediately able to get a great education at the University of Texas. This is about Raphael. Right after he arrived here and then went to work in the oil industry as a computer programmer. It never made sense to me how he and Eleanor wound up in Calgary and then later returned to the U.S. and he suddenly becomes a Christian minister, although he's never actually had a church he could call his own. Who has been paying Raphael all these years to advocate his dominionist views and now tell evangelical voters that his son was anointed by God as foretold in the Bible? You can't make this stuff up. You know the media is just waiting until if and when Cruz gets a nomination before it unloads on him. Was Eleanor's first husband an intelligence officer as well? And that, I take it, came from Gary Welsh. And let's go to number 12, too, now, Chance, please.
That's stunning, Jim. That passage is just stunning.
The timing of Welsh's death just prior to the Indian, now this, I think, comes from Wayne Manson. The timing of Welsh's death just prior to the Indiana GOP primary, one that Cruz hopes to win to keep his chances for the GOP presidential nomination alive, is troubling to say the least. Welch was a well-known advocate for election integrity, and he supported Donald Trump for the GOP nomination. His death leaves Indiana and its Christian fundamentalist, he calls him Fundy, Governor Mike Pence, freer to engage in all sorts of primary election malfeasance and chicanery on May 3rd. The profession of journalism is more bankrupt without the two Garys, Webb and Welch. That's from Wayne Madsen. Let's look at slide number 13.
Yeah, Donald.
I mean, here's he's raising a perfectly relevant question. I mean, what was he doing? What was he doing with Lee Harvey Oswald shortly before the death? And, you know, you have people like this guy, Chris Matthews, on MSNBC, Larry, who's saying that Trump is nutty for raising the question, that he's discredited himself. But Matthews knows so little about JFK that the ignorance he's revealing is his own. The guy is a mental midget. He knows nothing about JFK.
I don't think he's ignorant, Jim. I think he's just protecting the crown jewel.
So you think he's actually on an assignment here?
Well, you know what the crown jewel is, you know, and that's at the top of the list. You know, some years ago, you know, the CIA released a list of, you know, of the jewels, the protected jewels of the family, and the top of the list there is something that has always been suppressed, that where we have never been able to see what crown jewel, the top of the list jewel is in its revelation, and we all know and we speculate and we assume that it's the JFK assassination.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And here we have a final slide here of Rafael Cruz from just a day ago.
Yeah, with his Santeria, you know, praying for something to happen to Donald Trump.
This is really embarrassing. We got this little video clip about him handing out these flyers, right? And I think Chance has them. Am I correct? Chance, could you play this little video clip?
Oh, I sent that one.
Well, listen, we know there's a video there. We know the characteristics. We know we got Raphael in New Orleans with Lee Oswald handing out pamphlets. We know Chauncey said they were all working Operation Mongoose. Well, we got the photograph of him with Vesiana on Main Street in Dallas on the 22nd. Now, what's the probability that this guy would be in New Orleans with Lee Oswald and in Dallas with Antonio Vesiana and not be involved in the anti-Castro movement? I'd say the probability is exactly zero.
Well, it wasn't by chance, Jim. You know, there's a lot of information out there that these Cubans had actually been tracking JFK from city to city. And that day in Dallas, a lot of them were there actually lining the parade with signs, you know, hate signs, showing hate signs throughout the...
And there were a whole lot of CIA officials who are in Dallas paying their last respects at the corner of Main and Houston by the lamppost. There's a whole website devoted to all the familiar faces in Dealey Plaza. In fact, that's a title, Familiar Faces in Dealey Plaza. And it's just stunning how many officials were there, how many operatives, how many assassins were there. This is Chauncey Holton observed to me.
Yeah, Rip Robertson, David Morales, Lucien Conine, you know, the list is just extensive.
Gary, I want you to have a chance to come in and just comment on everything we've been talking about here, because you've been distracted by your baby and so forth. Tell us more. Just give us a rundown of your thoughts.
It looks like we've gone mainstream here. The highly possible president of the United States is basically quoting the OIC. So it seemed like we stepped into the big leagues in the last couple of days. And it is amazing that the establishment was not able to stop Trump. And we know that there is no support for Hillary. So they're going to have to pull out all the stops. And you know what? They just may not be able to pull it off. However, I hope it doesn't go the same way as JFK.
Well, I spent the first hour explaining why I think that the Donald is going to be able to draw a lot of supporters from Sanders, because they overlap enormously on their basic positions. Yeah. And how he's going to be able to outflank Hillary on the left in relation to foreign policy or support for the endless wars, which both he and Sanders oppose, and on trade policy for the TPP and NAFTA, which Bill introduced and which she has supported until she had to curtail it for the because she was getting too much criticism from the left. And, of course, from the right, he's going to be able to attack her on gun control. I think Hillary's going to be like a ping pong ball here, frankly. I think that the Donald's going to be able to do the job. Yeah. But if you go to the mainstream media, every one of them is saying Trump is going to be a disaster. He's going to cause the GOP to lose the Senate and the House. They're just giving the most uninformed remarks where they've spent no more time studying this issue than Chris Matthews has studying the assassination of JFK.
Yeah. How many times have you heard that the JFK case is an old case, it's 50 years old, what does it matter anymore? Well, this proves beyond any shadow of a doubt just how important and relevant the JFK assassination is to this very day. And it's, there were only two people left, Cruz and Trump, and the JFK assassination was important enough to have one of them step aside. And so now we have Trump as the nominee.
Gary, it's interesting that you raise that point because I got a couple of emails today from a group that was they were saying that this was good in part because it was pushing the JFK assassination, you know, onto the mainstream media to the forefront. And however, even though it was negative because they kept saying alluding to Oswald as the assassin instead of saying the alleged assassin, I kept saying it. There's no such thing as bad publicity. You know, as long as something like this is brought out, you know, to the forefront, and people, you know, especially the younger generation, start to look at this and say, wait a minute, you know, we haven't been taught about this in school. You know, let's look into it. You know, I think it's still a positive thing, you know, for anybody who is still looking for justice, you know, for Oswald and JFK. And just to finish here, I just wanted to ask Jim if he thought that these new revelations from Rafael Cruz were the exact turning point that made Ted Cruz withdraw from the race today. If that was exactly the reason where, you know, they did not want this to be investigated any further, or you know, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's why I
absolutely believe that, Larry. That Cruz wanted to protect his father, that his father may have gone too far. It wouldn't surprise me if his father had been involved in the death of this lawyer and blogger, Gary in Indianapolis, who was Gary Welch, who was calling for investigation, digging out all this dirt about the family, exposing. I think he would have seen it as a threat to his son's ability to become president of the United States and acted in the old way, you know, the old habits. Because in the old days, if there was a thorn in your side, you simply killed it, you know. I mean, this is a crude killing. It was no suicide. There are major investigative journalists on it now. And I think that Cruz was worried that if he stayed in the race, it was going to become a bigger and bigger issue, which is absolutely the case. I mean, we obviously aren't going to drop it. But I'll be very surprised if the mainstream media pursues it any further.
But I'm talking about from a higher level, Jim. Do you think there might have been, you know, instructions from at a higher level? You know,
from the Bush family,
or even higher.
It's entirely possible, Larry. before we conclude, I just want to shout out to Ralphs and Kay for the brilliant work he's been doing with the blog and keeping on top of these issues. I think he's doing wonderful work. We had hoped he could join us, but it looks as though he got his internet cut off, I'm willing to surmise, so he couldn't come on with us. But the thought had never crossed Ralph's mind. He hasn't been through what we've been through here on The Real Deal with Chance, having all his files wiped, having the channel take off of the air, all kinds of interruptions and mischief taking place.
And that's why you persevered today, and that's why JFK is relevant today. All right, so I'd like to thank Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, Chance George, and our youngest JFK researcher, Claire King, and myself. We'll see you next week for JFK 102.
Hi, this is Gary King. Here's a song written when I was just 18. People have always enjoyed this song, and finally, 40 years later, I went ahead and recorded it. If you like it, download it on iTunes. It's called I'm Not in Love, I'm Just in Heat. Gary King. Go to iTunes and download it if you like it. Song for 40 years, played at party after party after party in the city of partying, New Orleans, Louisiana. If you dig it, go to iTunes and download it. I'm Not in Love, I'm Just in Heat, Gary King. And I also hope you enjoy the programming we provide here. And if you're into JFK, you can go to my YouTube channel, Gary King YouTube. And I do a weekly show with Jim Fetzer, Don Fox, and Larry Rivera. Hope to see you soon.